Hello, everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Be sure to hear out for those two code words so that way you can get yourselves some free BACB CEUs. I am super excited to be talking with these two fabulous ladies from Kit Consulting. Their names are Jennifer Weber and Caroline Linfante. Welcome to the podcast, ladies.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to talk with you guys because, you know, the business model that you guys have is absolutely wonderful. And I'm so curious to know for our viewers and also for myself, too, how did you get inspired to create your business?
It's been a journey. Go ahead, Jen.
And it has. I think we both were very education driven. We both kind of came from more of the education background, and then we both entered the same program, master's program and PhD program, a little bit at a different time. I was, I think, 2 years ahead of Caroline. And then we both really kind of jumped into the consulting world. And I think we both were kind of doing the same thing, but just with different teachers, different types of classrooms and all of that. And then it kind of happened really organically to just come together, really put both of our different strengths together to try to build something, to try to build something a little bit more systematic.
Just to piggyback off of that, we both wanted to be teachers, I think, when we grew up, essentially. And we were able to do that and kind of continue be teachers in a public school setting. I had more of a self-contained teaching experience. Jen had a little bit more of a general education teaching experience. And we were able to continue to do that through our graduate programs using applied behavior analysis. So it was kind of this interesting marriage between working in a public school and teaching using the science. And then opportunities kind of were presented to us where we were able to move from teaching into consulting individually. And then it just, like Jen said, we found ourselves kind of repeating ourselves and setting up the same types of classrooms and giving the same recommendations to teachers that we said, how can we do this on a much more widespread level? So that's why we ended up joining forces and creating Kit Consulting.
That's awesome. That is so cool because, you know, there's not a whole lot of businesses like yours out there, you know, and we definitely need more out there, especially because, you know, going into a school setting, I don't personally work in a school setting, but I know people who do. And it sounds like the school systems sort of just need a little bit of help in general. And that's just from what I've seen.
Yes, they need a lot of help. And I think that with our model, by really coming in as consultants, bringing other people, on with us, it kind of allows us to have a unique lens within to be able to help the public school systems as well. We're not in the union, so we're not kind of having to deal with, oh, well, we can't really give the feedback to the teacher on the plan, or we can't make these recommendations because we're, you know, union, so we can kind of come in a little bit of a different light, which I think is what makes us and how we work with the school systems a little bit different than being kind of that full-time district BCBA.
And I'm sure you see it in the home setting too, where you're talking to schools from, you know, the home side of things. And I'm sure a lot of times you're saying, what is happening over there? You know, you almost wish you could just go in and show them what to do. And so yeah, it's kind of funny, right? When we're on the school side of things and we are coming from the school district, essentially, we can almost, it's great when we talk and can meet with home BCBAs because obviously we speak the same language. And so that also is another asset for the school district to have somebody that they know can build that rapport with the families at home, with the home BCBAs, and really try to set up that support across both settings, because we know that is a difficult bridge to maintain.
As an in-home and an in-clinic BCBA, I seriously appreciate that, because I know sometimes trying to coordinate with the teachers can be really, really difficult. I just got out of an IEP meeting not too long ago, and, you know, I see what the school is saying about progress with, you know, some of my children. And then I'm like, but they're doing really good in this area when we're at the clinic, but then they can't accept it from the school side because they're not directly teaching it. So it's like, it's a little bit more difficult, but also at the same time, it does show us, like, it does make us wonder, okay, what is going on? What's happening here? And how can we support, essentially, you know?
Yeah, I think in a perfect world, I think we've got to all find a way to have more collaboration between the clinic side, the home side, and the school side, because it's all equally so important. But kind of, and sometimes I know insurance may kind of dictate a little bit of it on the clinic and home side, which is challenging. So it's a bigger problem than I think any of us can solve here today. But I think when we kind of look at what we're focused on at the clinic side versus school side, there are those differences. But again, it's unfortunately sometimes because of the way that the insurance and the treatment plans and all that have to be written.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I can definitely agree with that. You know, it's something that, you know, as a BCBA, I'm trying to work towards every single day, trying to make sure that I'm checking in. And I know that on my end, you know, from being a clinic BCBA, sometimes it gets a little hard because, you know, we do have a few cases, but I also imagine too, teachers also have a lot on their plates. And so I think, you know, one thing that I've really learned is when we're collaborating, you know, we just need to give grace to each other just because we all have a lot on our plates. Every single one of us does.
Absolutely.
That's exactly it. And that's what, you know, we try to stay in the classrooms as much as possible too. We're not just, you know, sitting at home giving advice, say, yeah, take these first then boards, take a DRO, here you go, you know, having that teaching background and trying to stay abreast of what's going on in classrooms today, it is challenging. It's a post-COVID world. There's so many things that have changed in the last couple of years that keeping up with what the teachers are going through and what they can handle and what we can add to their plate. But we also have to kind of have a marketing background in a sense as well that Jen and I are learning as we are now a year and a half into our kit consulting of trying to sell, you know, ABA strategies. And yes, it's not just for clinics. It's not just for home. It's not just for toilet training. This can make your life easier. So we have to almost put on a marketing hat too and say, oh, we get it. We do, because we were teachers. We were in the classroom. Now, how can I make your life easier? Watch this. And we can still model things, model the data collection, because the D word is scary to a lot of people. I don't know if you see that also, Michelle.
A little bit, yeah.
they're like, what do you mean? What do you mean data? Like, no. You're already doing it. Let me just show you how you could just write it down or put it on a Google form or something like that. So it has been interesting going from being a teacher. Jen and I have both worked as university professors in various capacities as well, then also being businesswomen and then trying to sell. We have to sell. We have to kind of sell ABA and disseminate the science in a public school setting, which is like, you know, it's for autism. It's just for this one little niche. And it's like, no. I use it on my husband all the time. It's great. it's much more widespread.
And I think one of the hard parts with the selling is having to, it's like, you know, you can fix this really quickly if you do X, Y, and Z, like right now, you know, within a week, like you could put all these things in place right now and you know it's going to get fixed. But a lot of times it comes back to having to just shape the teacher's behavior. So it's like giving them that one small thing that they can digest and then like building on it is kind of what's been, I think, probably most successful with me. If I give them a full-on plan, it doesn't work. So I find myself using a lot of behavior momentum with the teachers to get them to that place that that I actually want them to be. But we also know if we don't kind of do it systematically in that sense, and we won't get the buy-in, and then we won't get the plan in place, and we won't get to really help the child.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can imagine how challenging that must be to, you know, to both try to like balance those things out, but then also you're still trying to ultimately like market a service and, you know, still help teachers and still help students. You know, that has to be a pretty challenging juggling act, I can only imagine.
It's so funny because it kind of takes the form, what you would imagine when you first starting a session with a new client or something like that. We take the exact same approach and apply it to working with teachers. So we, both of us, we actually started a kind of a different venture, not marketing ourselves as more educational consultants, not just DCBA, because that does kind of limit the scope. And we could be doing a lot more with the public education, especially now with teacher burnout being such a big thing these days and trying to figure out how can we help general education teachers. So Jen and I had to go into the school district and build rapport. We had to pair ourselves with the teacher because we know they've had people come in and say, you know, oh, you guys know what you're doing. You know, go ahead, here you go. And we had to really slowly, we didn't give any recommendations the first couple of weeks. We had to pair ourselves, give multiple reinforced, you know, oh my gosh, I love how you're teaching. This is like such a great thing. And it mirrors, you know, it's human behavior. It's the exact same thing. And now we're able to implement some strategies and they're seeing it because now we have the buy-in. We're able to set up some reinforcement systems class-wide. We have been working to do kind of an after-school tutoring program as well. So we're trying to implement motivational systems system-wide for all of the tutoring classrooms and things like that. So it's so funny how, you know, people out there might be thinking, this is crazy. How can I go and do this myself? And it's like, well, you already have the skills. Once you learned how to be a BCBA, you can kind of take that and translate it. It's just working with adults.
Exactly. And, you know, kind of on that too, I'm so curious to know, what strategies have you both used to help both teachers and students thrive, making their lives easier and making their learning and their teaching more effective for the students that they serve?
I think we could probably break that apart because there's the academic side, there's and the classroom environment side, behavior. I think both Caroline and I, when we do any kind of presentation for schools, we really hit and focus on the preventative strategies, like really getting teachers to kind of almost like make a lesson plan of their for their classroom environment and preventative strategies, and really kind of going in like, you're going to have students that behave because of the four functions of behavior. So let's just get ahead of it and kind of give them opportunity with feedback to make a plan of something small that's manageable, that's digestible, that they can do proactively. So that's kind of, I think, how we really focus on more of like the classroom environment and management side. I personally probably find, while I love the academic side, I like the academic side a lot. Like I would do that all the time if I could, or only do that. That one tends to be a little bit more challenging because now you've got teachers that are coming with their backgrounds of teaching, and you know, when there's kind of a behavior problem that's glaring, at some point there's some motivation there, at some point there's be some motivation for the teacher to do something to make their life better. But on the academic side, sometimes those academic issues are obvious to us because we're looking at data in a different light, or we're looking at what evidence-based practices, if any, are in place. But they're kind of looking at, well, I'm getting through this lesson right now, and it all seems great because I can get my lesson done. So sometimes on that academic end, I find that that's where it can be a little bit more challenging to really get in, because the issues are not always as glaring to the teachers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep, those preventative strategies are definitely our first stop. Even just we've had to set up self-contained classrooms before. We haven't really had to as much. Obviously, we're not setting up, you know, general education classrooms. Those are pretty self-explanatory. But in terms of setting up more of the self-contained classes, we do emphasize those preventative strategies, setting up expectations, and trying to get ahead of minimizing, especially the attention-seeking behaviors and the escape-maintained behaviors with frequent reinforcement. And that can come in so many different forms. So that's a lot of when we go in and do professional development workshops, we're speaking to those types of preventative strategies. And just like Jen said, you know, that also helps a lot to minimize challenging behaviors that might arise later on, but it also might help with motivation for academic challenges as well. And then Jen is, I like to think my specialty or my passion is a little bit more in managing the challenging behaviors. Jen is also equally as good at it, but she is much more motivated and passionate about the academic challenges, especially with reading. The science of reading now is finally, we're very excited, becoming the new wave of reading instruction. And so that, I think, and Jen could probably speak more to that, really breaking down how we teach kids how to read. We're very excited to be in on this movement now. Michelle, I don't know what you're seeing in the home and in the clinic too, if you're seeing this momentum. It's super exciting because now we can actually use science and show, look at how you can break this down. It's a trial, but it's not really, you know, it's feedback.
Absolutely. I would love to hear a little bit more, you know, about how you're incorporating the science of teaching and behavior analysis in improving academic outcomes for students and increasing test scores as well.
That's a big one.
Yes. I love it. I think that's the challenge that I like enjoy. Not to say that I don't love the other stuff, but that's I truly am passionate about this side of it. I think that one area has really been utilizing and really diving into the curriculums that people have in place and how to bring the science of teaching into that. So we're not, you know, in the reality of it, we're not going to be like, you need to like write a lesson plan this way when they already have to turn something in that the district wants. However, we can look at curriculums that are the published curriculums that teachers are using, the districts are using, and find those pieces to put in. So for example, most curriculums have a teacher model that I do, we do, you do model. So we can kind of shape in. So they're doing the modeling. They're doing some of that guided practice where they're doing it together. And then the students are doing some level of independent practice. So just even starting out with how to help teachers be able to give that feedback during the guided practice and the independent practice. So you're almost kind of making, it's a bigger trial, but you're almost kind of building in those trials into that is probably the first step that I usually encourage or focus on. And then utilizing some research-based strategies like choral responding, like response boards that really encourage more students responding, giving students more opportunities to respond, and then really focusing on with the teachers on how to give feedback, give the feedback and acknowledgement for when students are responding correctly, as well as being able to model and give that more corrective feedback. So the next time that they can, they'll hopefully get that skill correct. So that's probably the biggest area that I look at first. And then usually I would say that whatever the district diagnostic benchmarks are, I do a lot of diving into those as well. As well as the state data from the prior, you know, from the prior year as well. So one of the things that like I look at, and I work with several schools, but there was one school that prior to Caroline and I getting into business together, I've been involved with this school for a while in a different state. But I will really utilize the mid-year kind of data to really then use that to try to help prepare to raise test scores. So you kind of look at what the students are doing from the beginning of the year to the middle of the year. And to me, that's almost kind of like you're teaching. So you hope that there's gains being made. But in my eyes, that's almost like a baseline of then what we need to do for the second half of the year. So what practices have been working and what hasn't been working? And while, you know, a lot of people will say, and I do agree with that statement, that it's one data point, but I use that data point really strongly to just look at what are other pieces of the science than we can build in, because it's the same thing. We're not going to get in order to help teachers use more of a science of teaching, it's a shaping kind of process. And so we get a few, hopefully get a few good practices in, really firm up the feedback, kind of getting more trials in place, maybe using a little bit more of a task analysis to break down the skills. So that's stuff we do at the beginning, and then really use the mid-year data to drive what we do the rest of the year. Because you can't, if you have some data points of mid-year data and the student just hasn't made progress, then you really can't argue that doing the same thing is going to continue to work. Then we need to do a little bit more. So that becomes that motivation for that.
It's kind of funny how it is, like Jen said, applying trials on a larger scale. So just like I said, our pairing process, we're doing it with the teachers. We really are going in and working on shaping the teacher's behavior. So we're not worried. Yes, we can put some things in place that directly impact the student's behavior, but the student learning is a direct result of what we can do to help shape the teacher's behavior. And so kind of looking at that discrete trial, that unit of behavior of teaching, and how can we manipulate the antecedent and improve that? Then that's gonna have a direct impact on the student's behavior. Then we're gonna look at the C portion of the unit and see, okay, how can we really improve the corrections and the reinforcement? And it's on a much larger scale. So just like, if districts are using iReady or their state testing or whatever it may be, it does turn into almost a study in a sense that we can analyze the graph and kind of ask the teachers for their input, because we're still trying to maintain that rapport as well. And hopefully by then, by the mid-year, we have enough of a rapport regardless that we can say, hey, have you tried this? Okay, we did try this, it didn't work. So it is that partnership, and we kind of are coming in as the scientists and trying to help the teachers as our, manipulate their behavior in a positive way.
I love that, and it's so interesting because you talk about data point with the student scoring and progress. And, I work with a lot of students that do go to school, and we do sit on their IEP meetings, and we hear a lot about, the skills that they're working on for their IEP. And one of the things that I try to do as, BCBA is I really try to come in with the attitude of, yes, we're working on certain goals, but at the same time, I do want to supplement what you're doing. So that way, we're supporting you as well. We want to support your student in a variety of environments. And that being said, coordination of care is a very powerful thing that, everyone really should have. I know I, as a clinic/home BCBA, really try to do as much as I can with that. But that being said, I know that there are a lot of behavior analysts out there that do face some challenges with that. That being said, what would you advise for those behavior analysts who don't work in the schools, but do work with students in a variety of settings, so that way they can build that rapport with the in-school administration and help the student at the end of the day?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it comes down to that communication piece and establishing that relationship with the teacher, or establishing that relationship with your state is using a case manager like they do in New Jersey where we are, or the administrator, and having frequent check-ins. So it's not when your email pops up, it's an aversive situation when the teacher reads it. It's so simple, but it's almost just like, hey, it's Friday. Hope you're going to have a great weekend. How was it this week? And then here's two things that we've worked on this week at home or in the clinic. Do you have anything else to add or share? And that like really quick bite-sized information, there's so much information, so many emails coming out right now, but bite-sized communication points, I think go a really long way. And then you can, you know, those, I've worked with home BCBAs before in the school setting where we talk quarterly, monthly, you know, whatever it may be. I have a student that I'm working with now who's going through a rough time with some of his behaviors at school. And he was going through a period where he didn't really have home ABA and they're just starting it back up. So I'm so excited to be able to coordinate that care with the home BCBA, because now we can also set up some sort of homeschool contingency and have that carryover. So his behavior plan, we can kind of make it seamless going from across the various settings. It's not going to matter. So hopefully the behavior can be the same no matter where he goes.
That's so beautiful. I love that so much. You know, it just goes to show you that coordination of care just really is such a powerful thing. And, you know, it's really important that everyone is on the same page at the end of the day. You know, I know working with the students that I do, you know, it's one of those things where we're trying to make sure that, like, you know, we are in contact with the teachers, but then also too, like, we want to support them as much as possible too. And that's all we want to do. Like, that's all I know for, on my end, that's all I want to do is just support my student wherever they go, you know?
Yep. Yep. And that bite size, you know, if it's a Google form, even you're sending once a week, or, you know, asking them to fill out something that's really quick and easy. You're not looking for a gigantic meeting, a gigantic paragraph of explanation of how the week went. I think the little bits kind of maintain that continuity.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with the little bits. And I think really focusing on the student at hand, I've had some home BCBAs do observations in schools. And sometimes if it's a classroom I'm overseeing, I have to like co-observe in case anything comes up from it. And I'll tell you, there's been a BCBA observations for that student that the entire report that they then produce has been about the classroom or just the teacher. So it becomes more evaluative. And then all of a sudden that collaboration becomes incredibly aversive, understandably so, because you think this person's coming in to observe the student, see how we could all, you know, connect that homeschool together. And then it's completely, you know, it's completely opposites.
So interesting, because I've done evaluations myself, and you know, one of the things that I do try to look at is, you know, not just like how a student behaves, but I'm looking at the environment too. You know, I'm looking at like what's the classroom structure, what is the teacher doing, what how many adults are in the classroom, how many students are in the classroom. And I think for me, the way that I'm seeing it is I want to know if there's any specific setting events, but I can see where you're coming from, where it turns into less about observing the student and more evaluating the classroom. So I can see where you're coming from with that.
And you do need, and it's that tough balance, because you do need to really look at the whole environment to really see to be able to identify any setting events to kind of be able to best help the child. But I think where I've seen it go the other way has really been when it's like over 90% just about what's the classroom has maybe done wrong, as opposed to what does the child kind of, what adjustments or what maybe environmental changes would benefit just that specific child. So it kind of gets like almost off task a little bit from the original goal.
So interesting. So let's say like I were to go into a classroom and do just an evaluation, you know, just to see like how my student is responding. What would be your advice for me to kind of like get outside of evaluate the classroom and get my head into evaluate the child? Like, what are some details that you think I should consider, so that way I'm not being aversive in the classroom? I'm literally just focusing on my kid.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think the best, when I've had to co-observe, I think the best observations that I've done with a home or clinical BCBA in the classroom has really been when the BCBA has taken like a minute or two to even see if they can email with the teacher prior, or if the school allows it, to like connect for 2 minutes prior to the observation, just to kind of ask the teacher what's been the hardest part, or what's been the most challenging for the student. So it's almost like then the BCBA is coming in with this like a little bit of a focus on, while the BCBA is looking at everything, but also like maybe there's some salute, maybe there's something here that could also help a challenge that the teacher is consistently seeing. And then through that, being able to collaborate on that home and school collaboration side of it.
Okay. I've seen too, I use a data sheet that I've used now for a few years, because you want to compare, you know, the child that you're working with, but you also want to see compare that student's behavior to peers in their class. And that might be impacted based on the teacher's interactions with your student versus that teacher with other peers in the classroom. Other peers interacting with your student versus other peers interacting with other peers. So I think obviously maintaining as objective data as possible. So I take interval data on, you know, if I'm going in and observing a student for an FBA, I will take my interval data of on-task versus on-task behavior data for my student, but I'll also take on-task and off-task interval data for one or two other peers, depending on how many he's sitting with. So then you can kind of have objectively, you know, my target student percentage of how much of the 30-minute observation they were on task compared to one or two peers. I also, in my data collection form, have frequency counts of how often the teacher is approving or giving reinforcement to my student and the two peers, maybe disapprovals, and even just some other, you know, behavior frequency counts I might do as well. But then when you're in your report, you might have that the teacher was very disapproving to your student, very approving to the peers. But when you refine the report, it's how you phrase it and say, you know, Johnny really benefits from frequent approvals. And we see that behaviors are minimized when approvals are given to that student, you know, example, peer A and peer B or something like that. So it's almost like the way that it's phrased, because we've gotten reports before where it's just kind of like, okay, this is a dumping on the teacher. Oh my God, this is not going to work. And we feel bad because we're fellow BCBAs. We're almost like, I wish we could have heard beforehand, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. Keeping everything objective and then refining it in a way that really focuses on what benefits your student, I think is another helpful tip.
That's actually so eye-opening for me. I this is going to sound really silly, but I've been in enough of my clients' schools and I hadn't thought about that. You know, I'm more focused on like, okay, what's my student like in the classroom and how are they doing in the classroom? But I think it's actually such a great idea to compare a little bit with other peers and maybe doing interval data, maybe seeing how the teachers are responding to behaviors in the classroom, providing reinforcement. I know that like that sounds very silly, but it's very true. I mean, I would have never thought about that at all.
I'm happy to share my data sheet with you and your listeners. Happy to share it.
Absolutely. I love that so much. Oh my goodness.
And I think sometimes too, it's when we're so focused on one student, whether it's the student that we're working with home or clinic, or it's a student like on our school caseload, or that we're overseeing a behavior plan for something, sometimes I think the expectations for that student sometimes ends up being higher than, you know, other students. Like, I'll give you the example. There's a student that I've been overseeing a behavior plan for, and it was like there was something going on at lunch, and it was like, you know, their substitute lunch aid. And you know how that can, go. So everything kind of went out the window. And it was like five kids had the same exact issue, one with the behavior plan. And it was like the kid with the behavior plan was getting a tougher consequence, you know, or it was a bigger deal than everyone else. So sometimes having that lens of comparing also, like, you know, lets us make sure that we're also like looking at the child under the same, you know, kind of not holding that child to a higher expectation just because we have more eyes on that specific child. And maybe we're taking more data on the child. And I find I come across that more often than not.
Absolutely. I appreciate this so much. And again, like I'm really just, my eyes have been opened in a lot of different ways. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. No, it's so funny. It's such a different environment. And if you're not used to, it's not good or bad or anything, but if you're not, it's not your day to day, obviously. If I, you know, I haven't been in a clinic in a long time. If I had to go to a clinic, it would be entirely different. It's part of why I don't go into homes as much, because each home is so different. And that schools I can handle, you know, everybody has their strengths and weaknesses with the various settings. So we'll have to come ask you questions on how we can get into homes and be successful with that as well. So that'll be next. That'll be another episode.
Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and go into our first code word. Our first code word is actually a verbal operant. It is manned. It is M-A-N-D. That word is manned. You know, and it's so interesting too, because the home and clinic dynamic are even different in of itself versus, you know, the school environment too. Cause you know, when we're in a clinic, we're in this like very, very like structured setting, not to say that any other setting is not structured, but in a clinical setting, you're a lot more isolated. Where in home, it's almost like you're in, more of like a child safe space, or where they're supposed to be. Yeah. You know, so it's so interesting. It's so interesting to kind of like learn about that too.
And we, I think actually I would love to ask you this, Michelle. We've heard a lot recently, and I'm sure your listeners are working on this type of stuff too, on Dr. Hanley's enhanced choice model and My Way and all that different types of things. And we are finding it challenging. This is something that's difficult to do in a school setting. And I don't know if you found with your students that have moved from clinics to schools, how successful they have been, how can they move successfully if they have that type of behavior plan? We've kind of modified it a little bit to make it fit in a school setting, but we find you need a one-to-one, you need a very safe space, you need all these different resources that are so challenging that we're like, oh my God, a clinic is the perfect place for this. That's why it's so successful. But we would love to hear if you've had any success moving that into a school setting.
Unfortunately, I can't say that I have. I've had that's more success in the clinic, but definitely not in a school setting.
That's good to know.
it is something though that I am really like interested in sort of seeing a little bit more, you know, kind of seeing how the enhanced choice model can be moved in a variety of environments rather than just in a clinic, or even like I've seen it in the home be successful as well. Sure. But again, it has to be one-on-one. It has to be super duper structured in order for it to happen.
And I think that speaks a lot to a lot of challenges that we do have in the school setting, is that there's a lot of times where it's like, as the behavior analyst, you know, looking at the function of the behavior, needing to put in a plan, we know what the student really, really needs. So maybe it's that enhanced choice model or the My Way, but we're limited by the school, certain school contingencies. So even going as far as, will the school provide a one-to-one to even help implement the behavior plan? There's a lot of across the board, and I don't think this is not just in education. I think it's across the board. A lot of people don't want to be working in person, it seems like, these days. So, you know, hiring assistants is a constant challenge as well. So I think one of the things that we're constantly up against is, how do we create an effective behavior plan? How do we really set up the environment that the child needs in a school setting with not even really having access to some of the resources that if we could, we would recommend?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that I get really curious about too is, you know, a little bit about like the misconceptions. you know, because there's definitely a lot of misconceptions of ABA in a lot of different settings, but I do hear about it in schools too. So how do you work to undo or prove those misconceptions wrong when you're implementing ABA and behavior analysis in the school setting?
Yeah.
I think, yeah,
it's part of our marketing hat in that we've had to undo a lot of bad ABA, and we've had to recondition to get nerdy ourselves. It's part of our pairing process. And it's not about coming in and saying, well, this is how ABA is, so this is what you need to do. It's more, well, the research supports, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then it's more about the proof is in the pudding. It's more about, okay, give me a week and let me try it. And when they see the results, it's like, oh, okay. And it's, oh, you're not just here to make a child robotic, or they have to earn something. They have to, you know, it's all about sticker charts and token systems. No, there's a purpose. So it's again, going back to that rapport building and trying very small things to get buy-in. And once we can get that buy-in, the next step on the task analysis or the shaping procedure, essentially, it's another marketing scheme, really. And we have to be successful in what we are implementing. So it does come with some pressure with that, because you know that they've seen it done incorrectly and something hasn't worked in the past, and they just have a bad taste in their mouth with ABA. We've had some pretty good successes by just saying, give us a chance and let us try it again.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, something that I do from the get-go, or try to do, depending on how the conversation is going, is relate it to their own, you know, life. Going from as simple as, would you be coming to work today if you weren't getting a paycheck, and trying to make those connections on, because I'll get a lot of pushback still on the token economy and token boards and point systems and all that, and kind of relating it to the world we live in being a token economy, and kind of trying to relate small pieces of ABA on how it impacts our adult lives and influences us from that lens. So I try to kind of bring it as much as possible on that level. It's not undoing anything other than just trying to change the misconception of it, and kind of see that we all benefit from these principles, and we all function in life because of these specific principles.
It's always great when you have to try to re-explain token economy, and the you know, teacher, whomever, has a Dunkin' Donuts cup or a Starbucks cup, and I want to say, show me your app. How many stars do you have? Are you going to get your free coffee soon? You know, it's like, oh, you want to have that conversation when they have their coffee cup in front of us. It's like, yes.
I laugh because that's so true. I mean, like, the Starbucks example is a perfect example. And though I don't usually use a whole lot of token economies with my clients, I see exactly where you're coming from, you know, with why, you know, it might be a good idea to use a token economy and of course, it's always dependent on the students, dependent on what the learner's needs are. But at the same time, I do appreciate you saying that, because I mean, I relate so much to that. I mean, how many Starbucks stars do I have? You know, like, I can literally pull up my phone right now.
Right. Exactly. The rewards, you know, you get a free turkey at ShopRite when you spend this much before Thanksgiving. It's like, yeah, here you go.
Oh my gosh. One of the other things that I get really curious about is, you know, when it comes to creating inclusive environments, how do you help schools create those inclusive environments that both keep students in public education rather than necessarily like moving them out and moving them into more of like a private setting? So that way they don't end up having, you know, even more changes than they already have.
I think that that's a tough question in the sense that it's an excellent question, but a tough question in the sense that I think it's a huge challenge in the schools. And the success of it is really, I'll say, based on the administration, that wants to set up those kind of parameters for the students. So we've been in districts where we've done presentations just on that. How do we create inclusive environments in even like special area classes in physical education and art and music so we can include all students? We've done presentations on differentiating instruction. We've done presentations on that environment, but sometimes we find that depending on the school, maybe that set of administrators only is targeting the self-contained teachers, let's say, then we're not going to be able to effectively train the in-class support teachers, the general education teachers, the special area teachers. Then we've had other administrators that will put the in-class support teachers and self-contained teachers in the same training so we can all kind of learn to work together. So I would say that the most effective is when the administration has really made that a priority, because some of it does come down to holding the teachers a little bit the general education teachers a little bit accountable to also have to make some classroom changes and not just be self-contained teachers that need to make those adjustments into their classroom. And we have been fortunate to work in some places where we have had administration support, and we have even done presentations for PE teachers, art teachers, music teachers. So at the bare minimum, when they go into kind of those specials or they go to an art or music class, those teachers are learning how to set up their classroom environment to really include all students.
It's kind of, yeah, especially the special area classes we're seeing across many districts that we're working in is kind of the Wild West in a sense for education, because it's when the classroom teachers get their prep. So it's kind of a place where it's just a free for all and we're just sending everybody because they're on their prep. You know, we're trying to respect that, and that's fine. But then the specials teachers are caught without a lot of support. Hopefully they are having the paraprofessionals there with them and they're not taking their lunches and breaks at that time. So that's super helpful, but it's another learning trial, right? It's about setting up, like Jen said, the expectations coming from the administrators from the beginning that these are everybody's students. It's not that the students from self-contained classes are sitting in the back and they're just hanging out. That's not inclusion. It's about defining what inclusion looks like to all of the teachers. And then it's about more frequent communication between the specials teachers or the general education teachers and the self-contained teachers and figuring out what works best. And we found success. There's been little occasional instances where the specials teachers have acted as subs in the self-contained classroom. Mm-hmm. Were you just going to say that, Jen? Yeah. For the paraprofessionals, sometimes they've had to come and act as a sub, and they've gotten the most obvious, that's the best training you could ever get. So we're not saying as a rule, I mean, there's of course union contract, whatever deals that have to happen in all the districts with how that works. But that's been the most effective that we've mm-hmm. seen. And it's kind of just happened by accident. Because there was a need for somebody to sub for a paraprofessional, and the PE teacher stepped in, the art teacher stepped in, and they go, oh, I get it. Because they make that connection with the student more one-on-one. So if we could make that as a recommendation, we do. But there's logistics that go into that as well. So it's been interesting. It's something we're still working on and trying to figure out what is most effective to make that happen.
You know, I love that you say that too, because I know that I've seen some of that happen before where, like, you know, we've had a sub come in and it's been someone who has, you know, helped out in those specific areas. And then the other thing I've also looked at too is, you know, with LRE, you know, client having to move mm-hmm. specific classrooms in the best interest of finding what is considered LRE, which for our listeners who don't know, that's considered least restrictive environment for the student. And I know that at times that gets really, really hard to navigate because you want to make sure you find the right setting for the student. But at the same time, you know, you might like advocate that maybe this particular setting isn't the most appropriate too. You know, that's something that I've seen happen over the course of my career on a number of occasions. And I know that it can be really hard to accept that this particular setting is not the least restrictive for your child. Or they might be like, okay, I want to move into a different classroom. I feel like this is super restrictive and I want to move up, you know? So I've seen some of that happen before too. That being said, how do you navigate that? How do you navigate those types of conversations when there's advocacy involved in changing the LRE in some capacity?
Data. I would say that the data that you can't really argue with, you know, we're trying to navigate that right now. A teacher and I are working closely and we're using the students' academic data to show that the student is not really in the least restrictive environment now. But of course it comes into, but of course it goes back to some of the overall challenges that come from, you know, higher up administration, logistics, all of that. But when possible, I try to utilize just data in general to show that. Sometimes even like a check, I've made some checklists in the past too. I know that even though the book was a while ago, Gina Green has a great chapter in her book about students being successful in inclusion settings. I'm getting the exact name of it, what the chapter's called wrong. And it's still very, that chapter is still incredibly relevant. And she kind of lists out a lot of the skills that students need to be successful in an inclusion setting. So I use that too, to kind of drive some of those conversations as well. So it's less about the placement, but more about what are the specific skills that the student is now demonstrating that is telling us that where the student currently is really not the least restrictive environment for that student.
And that's kind of our ultimate mission with what we're doing, is ensuring the correct placement, whether, and you know, a lot of our work in the public schools is trying to maintain students within the school and not having to go out of district. It does happen because sometimes they need a more clinic approach and different things like that. So what we try to do is also structure our self-contained classrooms with programs that are not just academic or activities of daily living, but teaching them how to learn. So there might be, you know, as part of the data that we're collecting to show, should they move up or down the continuum, can they learn in a group? Can they learn by observing their peers? Can they learn incidentally? You know, if you're just walking around and you say, that's a bus outside, will they remember that that's a bus later on? And then through our graduate program training, there are protocols that we have to be able to teach these skills as well. So we're very excited to be able to kind of, you know, pass that knowledge on to other teachers, because it's another level of learning. And even in the inclusion setting, you know, teaching those appropriate skills of sitting in a group might be step one, and trying to scaffold what it looks like to sit in a whole group, a small group. How do you respond appropriately, and trying to move up and down the continuum by identifying the different learner behaviors that or skills that are actually missing. So that's part of the data collection that we try to help our teachers navigate as well. And so, yeah, it's a lot of moving factors.
Absolutely. You know, and I appreciate you saying that, because I run into that sometimes. And like I said, I've run into it in my career a few times now. And it's like, I can only imagine how difficult it must be to have to have that conversation, come up with that decision. I know some families get really upset by hearing that result, but also too, it's an unfortunate reality, you know, and it's not because of anything more than just the data. You know, data does talk a lot more than we think.
Yep, absolutely. And that's what we try to establish ourselves. And that's part of what we do when we go into self-contained classrooms, and is part of our rapport building. Because of our experience of being in the classroom, we're able to kind of, we try to say, let me take this off your plate. So we have, you know, pre-made data forms, whether that's using printed out data forms and things like that, or Google Sheets where things are calculated automatically. We even have developed our own curriculum as well for self-contained classes, because if you have a teacher that's coming into a brand new classroom, they are already stressed to the max, trying to set up the environment, trying to set up what each student individually needs. But a lot of starting points, and that's what we kept trying to do over and over again, was we were writing the same programs and lesson plans over and over again. So we said, why don't we just write this as a curriculum? And so we've been sharing that with our teachers and trying to get that set up as well, so that they don't have to worry about it. They can just worry about individualizing the programs as they're needed, with the different prompt hierarchies and things like that with their kids, or the behavior plans and building that rapport. So with us trying to come in and make teachers' lives easier, they can hopefully focus on more inclusion-centered activities and approaches, which I think is really what being a special educator is about. You're delivering that curriculum, but you're really trying to meet your kids where they're at and try to push them forward along that continuum of LRE.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to go ahead and drop our second code word, and it is yet another verbal operant. It is the word TACT, T-A-C-T, that is TACT. So just some final questions I have. What would you say are your long-term goals for expanding behavior science in educational settings with the consulting business that you have?
We have a few goals. Just a few, and that we were going to meet next week, as it's nearing the end of the year as we're recording this in 2024, to set up our goals for 2025, our vision board. Not as behavior analytic in nature, but we still use it. It's okay. So we are looking to expand a little bit more towards RBT training and BCBA supervision. We have been super fortunate to have hired some independent contractors underneath us who are BCBA level and can go out into school districts and kind of be more of on the ground doing the work that we're doing. So we're looking to expand that as well. Jen, we've got a few other things in the works too, right?
We do. We're really looking to continue to kind of build and work on our curriculum development. So we've got a curriculum right now through Unitas TI that has been kind of a project over the past year of kind of putting all the lesson plans tied to the ABLES and BBMAP all in one place, and working with that company to be able to use that in school. So that's a big goal, as well as also developing resources to help families as well, to be able to kind of teach some of these skills in a way that's not, doesn't feel like teaching at home too, because we know that home piece is so important.
Especially for the younger learners. We kind of were developing this. I have a 2-year-old son, and as a nerdy BCBA might, I was just looking at the VB map and looking at his skills and just seeing where he was. But there were some things on it that I was like, oh, I've never thought to just kind of do a sorting activity with him. Or I've never, you know, there are just certain things on the VB map that I was like, oh, you just don't think about kind of working with that with your child, or at least I never did, even though I like to nerd out on things like that. So we were saying, we are trained BCBAs. If we're not thinking about these kinds of things, how overwhelming must it be for parents who don't have this type of experience? So just, if you're out for a walk with your children, what could you be talking about in just kind of a more targeted manner that's improving language skills and trying to, you know, help early intervention in a sense, without making it early intervention. So we're trying to develop some family newsletters and things like that as well to try and really just create a well-rounded, holistic approach to helping families with kids with autism or just typically developing as well.
I love that. I love that you guys are building these resources. You're doing a whole curriculum for it. I mean, goodness, that's such a great resource for everybody to have. I mean, that's really awesome. And I appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah, we're excited.
Yeah. And my last question is just, you know, I've talked a lot about coordination of care, but I kind of want to go back to the teachers. What advice would you give to brand new teachers or just teachers in general setting up their classroom for the very first time to help foster all of this learning and yet at the same time, you know, sort of understand and help them in the long run.
I think I would definitely encourage, and Caroline probably knows what I'm going to say, on focusing on the basics, like teaching the rules, looking at your classroom structure, really focusing on the classroom environment as the very first. I think I've been in classes with new teachers where they're trying to hit the ground day one with curriculum or things that aren't really appropriate for the students. So really that getting to know the students, setting up a really structured classroom environment with the schedule, with rules that you can work on, and just focusing on the basics at the very beginning. I think new teachers sometimes want to show everything that they're capable of doing day one, but that's not for day one and the first few weeks of school is about building that rapport, establishing expectations and norms. So really doing the work on the foundational pieces.
I heard one of my teachers actually talk about how running, especially when you're setting up a self-contained classroom, it's trying to figure out what house projects to work on first, because you're just kind of whacking a mole with what you want to work on. And then you feel like you're running all over the place and it could be so easy to burn out. So exactly what Jen was just saying, you don't have a house without a basement and a foundation. And that foundation is the classroom rules, because that sets up your expectations right mm-hmm. away. And that tells you exactly what you're going to reinforce and tend to, and what you're going to follow through and not reinforce in your classroom. So that is your driving force, your foundation for the class, and everything else once will kind of fall into place once you get those procedures and routines. And it, that's easy to not do. It's an easy step to skip. So we think that is really, if you don't have that, you're gonna be calling us for help with behaviors.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, ladies. I really appreciate your time and you coming onto the podcast. Can you give us any information on where we can contact you or where we can find you?
Yeah, we have an Instagram. It's kit.consult. We have a website, www.kitconsult.org. And that's where you can really find all of our resources, information on our curriculum. Feel free to reach out to us. We are happy to collaborate with teachers. If you are drowning and you just need a little bit of help, we can point you in the right direction if we don't have the answers. So those are our two main places. We have a TikTok that's also going kit.consult. So give us some reinforcement on there too, because we're trying to just launch that as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, ladies. I really appreciate your time. And thank you everyone for tuning in. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Bye.